Karina, welcome to Late Nights and to Cape Talk. It is such a pleasure. And this is the second time we've been sitting in close proximity in the last 48 hours.
And what a wonderful way to meet. Thank you so much for having me.
No, thank you. Thank you. The title of the book, then, is The Fifth Mrs. Brink. For those who haven't yet read it, is it about you? Is it about your late husband, André?
It is mostly about our relationship, but I do tell quite a few stories about myself. But I specifically chose the stories that illustrate why the 10 years that we had together were so special to me.
Yeah. How long after his death did you start writing the book? And was it a book when you started writing?
It was, in a sense, it wasn't really the book when I started writing. There are passages in the book included that are taken almost directly from my diary. Mm. And so that writing process began much earlier than the idea for the book. And the diary also wasn't almost, it wasn't immediately after André's death. I tried to write, as one can see in the book then, but it was a long time until I could properly return to writing as such. And the diary was the only place where I was writing anything. And then the idea for the book really started a long, long time ago, just after we got married. I teased André that one day I would write a book and I would call it The Fifth Mrs. Brink. And he thought it was hilarious. And he said, yes, you must do that one day. And I continued teasing him about it for as long as we were together. And then it was in December 2015, on a very specific day. It was on the day that we... the anniversary of the day when we met 11 years later, I decided if I'm ever going to write this, today I will start and see whether it will happen. And it did. And the passage that I wrote back then, it was on the 5th of December 2015, is not in the book. But it was a passage that got me going. And then I really started writing in February 2016.
Yeah. I want to talk about, and you said 11 years after you met, I want to talk about your first meeting in Salzburg, it was actually one of my favorite parts of the book. I haven't finished yet, so there's still more to come. But I just thought it was funny, it was tender, it was beautiful, it was lovely. You say that you'd taken pity on him.
Yes, I did. And I have a tendency of meeting the most wonderful people when that kind of compassion comes to me. André, we invited him to a conference, and while we were organizing everything, we realized that we booked him this insane flight. He had, I think, two or three stopovers, and then he still had to take the train from Vienna to Salzburg in order to get to the conference. And then I said to the main organizer of the conference, I said to her, you know what, somebody should at least go and pick him up at the airport. This poor man would have traveled across the world. He will be tired, and somebody at least should take over the logistics of that last part of the trip. And then she looked at me and said, well, you have read a few of his novels. You are not going to embarrass us, so why don't you go? And that's how I ended up in Vienna.
And there it was. And you say, sort of love at first sight, there was an instant connection between the two of you. Had you believed in love at first sight before you met André?
I hope that I did. Right now, I do not know whether I really did, but I think I did, because I was always, like André, I was always a romantic, and I always believed in the magic of love. But during my life, it hasn't always manifested. Mm. So it was really until I met him that everything that I imagined love could be then became reality in a relationship.
Mm. And you were married at the time that you met André.
Yes, and that is why that first encounter was such a strange and unacknowledged encounter. We did have this connection, and something was happening, but both of us were not acknowledging it. Only afterwards, when he went back to South Africa and we started corresponding to each other, and I mentioned in one of the letters that I am actually now in the process of divorcing my husband, that he then said, well, that is maybe a good thing.
Yeah.
And then through the correspondence, we exchanged our souls and put a lot of wonderful things into writing that explained ourselves to each other. And then we met a few months later at another conference in Paris and realized that everything that we had written was real.
Yeah.
And that it had a way of existing in the world.
Shortly before his death, I'll go back a little bit, but Andre allowed letters and photographs between he and his former lover, Ingrid Jonker, to be published. How did you feel about that?
A lot of people wondered about that.
Mm.
But I think that, first of all, most readers did not realize until I started speaking about the project that obviously because I was the copyright owner, this could not have happened without my permission.
Mm.
So obviously I was behind it and I allowed it to happen and I curated it into the world. And I felt like something was happening that was special in a way that I was still fulfilling something that Andre wanted.
Mm.
So it felt as if we were still working on something together.
Mm.
But obviously it wasn't really the case.
Yeah.
But in the beginning when he died, it did keep me going for a very long time. That project was like a lifeboat.
Yeah, yeah. You talk, you said that Andre had laughed at you saying, well, I'm going to write a book and it's going to be called The Fifth Mrs. Brink. But you really are the fifth Mrs. Brink. You were very young when you met. How becoming the fifth Mrs. Brink at such a young age, did you feel a pressure and did you feel that you were becoming the fifth Mrs. Brink and heaven forbid there be a sixth Mrs. Brink?
Well, you know, officially there is one. There is a very weird story. Years ago, Andre was doing an interview for The Guardian. And after the interview, I think it was only the next day, he looked at me and said, you know what? I might have told this journalist that you are my sixth wife. And I said to him, oh, no, you need not worry. Surely, this is The Guardian. Surely they will check their facts. And the man didn't. He trusted Andre to know how many times he was married. So this Guardian article appeared with that fact. And obviously, since then, whoever wants to check their facts, they go to The Guardian.
Yeah.
Because surely The Guardian would not have made a mistake.
Yeah.
And so there is this mythical sixth Mrs. Brink out there. And I then teased Andre that I'm quite sure that she's still up there in the attic. We just haven't looked. And I also teased him about the fact that he was actually the second Mr. Sturek.
Mm.
So it wasn't like I was extremely young, but I wasn't going into this with no experience whatsoever.
Mm.
And Andre in my life helped me heal from that experience of the divorce. And he also always teased me about the fact that when we were traveling from Vienna to Salzburg on that first journey, that I said to him a few times, my husband, mm-hmm. my husband. And then he kind of felt that I was telling him, you know, hands off.
Back off.
Yeah. Yes. And now, it seems that it was easy, that everything fell into place. And that is how it was. But it wasn't something that didn't require a lot of work.
Mm.
So in the beginning of our relationship, it took months and months of conversations and opening up of all these wounds and taking off the scabs of some of them and looking at the scars and looking at simply what is it that attracted us to one another? And then what is it that has failed us in relationships before? Mm. And now how to move forward? And we had that really, really, I am beginning to realize, the older I get, I'm beginning to realize more how rare it is for two people to really and truly talk to one another mm. and be honest and dig deep and say, well, you know, I am also sometimes depressed and ugly inside, and I'm full of anger and disappointment, and this is also who I am. Mm. And we love each other, and it's all right to not be all right.
Mm. Mm.
So, yeah, it was a lot of hard work. And then once that work was done, we also made sure that there was a lot of time for the relationship. And for things that were important to us, and for people who were important to us. And so we spent a lot of time together, and we worked and lived together. We basically, for those 10 years, we were only a few days apart.
Mm.
And it worked, and we were always very calm and happy in each other's presence.
Mm. When you married him, for those who haven't read the book yet, what were the reactions from both families?
Very surprising on both sides.
Mm.
Andre's family welcomed me with a little bit of apprehension, which was only natural, but really welcomed me.
Mm.
And it was interesting to see that I would have accepted just about any reaction from them, because anything would have been all right. And yet there was a lot of kindness and a lot of openness to see, well, who is this person and why is this happening? And so there was a lot of warmth there. Mm. And on my side, my mom was delighted, because she knew how much I had suffered. And she saw that I was beginning to somehow just feel alive again.
Mm.
And my father also, he, when I told him, you know, I'm actually falling in love with this man who is your senior by quite
some
a lot.
Time. Yes.
Because my father only turned 60 this year.
Mm.
Mm. And he also, he just turned around and looked at me and said, but Karina, you are happy, right? And I said, yes, I am. And he said, so what's the issue? And so that is how it was. And then from more extended family circles and family circles, people had a lot of worries.
Mm.
But they also, the moment they saw us together, it all fell away.
Mm.
And also the age gap. Anybody who hears 42 years of difference will say, insane. What are these people doing?
Mm.
But the moment that they saw us and experienced us as a couple, that disappeared. And it disappeared between us as well, apart from the natural reality of biological facts.
Yeah.
That we knew that if nature did its thing at some stage, I would be here alone, and there was no way out of it. But we were prepared to take that risk. We understood that what was happening was special and worth fighting for, and also worth living.
Yeah.
And that you never really truly know. Biologically, yes, I was meant to outlive Andre.
Mm.
But I also could have died in an accident a week after getting to know him.
Yeah.
So you never know.
So and it wasn't like this dark cloud hanging over you.
Never. Yeah.
Yeah.
I did think about it, and we both thought about it, and we discussed it, and Andre always said to me, please, you know, you must, when this happens, you must live and you must love again and you must be happy, because this is what I wish for you. So it wasn't unacknowledged. It was also something that we were aware of, and it was discussed and lived also together.
Yeah. In writing the book, did it help you grieve, or were there times when in writing it actually felt more painful to relive and mourn your time together?
Both. The writing helped in the sense that when I write, I try to find understanding. I make sense of what happens around me and inside me through writing. Mm-hmm. That's why I'm a diarist. Yeah. And as a writer, I also process quite a lot in the open and in publications. So in that sense, this was extremely helpful, because the moment I started putting these things into words, they weren't easier, but I understood them.
Mm.
And the moment you understand things, they become less frightening. That has always been my experience, that the moment you start understanding what you are experiencing, then it becomes easier to then live through it. But there are passages in the book that I had no recollection of actually seeing while I was writing.
Mm.
Because I was typing through horrors of weeping.
Absolutely. I absolutely relate to that.
Yeah.
You know, and having written a memoir also, there's times when I will go back or someone will ask me to read something from the memoir and I think, I don't even remember writing this. But I know I did, but I don't remember writing it.
Mm. And you will also know that, I mean, in your book, you also write from the heart. Mm. You open yourself up. You've made yourself extremely vulnerable in that book.
Mm.
And so while one is doing it, you are also, I mean, I was very scared. Was I exposing myself to maybe possibly more hurt?
Mm.
And yet, I hope that you're experiencing the same thing as I am. I know that as a reader of your book, I just felt there is somebody out there who understands things.
Yeah.
And there she was putting them into words, and now I can read them. And even though we have met, yesterday for the first time,
exactly.
And it's a very uncanny feeling that after having read your book, I kind of feel that I know things about
exactly.
you that maybe I shouldn't officially know.
Yeah, exactly.
And there is a connection, and it might not translate into anything, but in my own life, even when we never see each other again, I will always carry that understanding. Mm. Also, there is this woman out there who understands some parts of me,
exactly.
like maybe no other.
Yeah,
which is such a gift
Isn't
to
it
a reader.
It's just wonderful, and I think to a reader and to a writer, and memoir is one of those genres, I think, where unless you are going in with complete honesty, there's not really a great deal of point in writing it, because readers can tell when you're not being authentic. They can tell when you're trying to make yourself look perhaps better or more appealing or whatever than you are.
Mm.
And you certainly have not done that in this book at all. You know, it's honest and it's real and it's, you can feel it's tangible. In that, and obviously we spoke at the beginning, you've used bits from your diary. Were there times when you thought, oh, this is too much and I feel too naked?
The whole time.
Yeah.
And I remember when I was asked to send in the first passages, I thought, no, I can't do this. I cannot share this. This feels like, you know, ask me to make a speech naked in the middle of a full stadium.
Mm.
I can do that. But don't ask me to see my work.
Yeah.
Which was very revealing to me about what I was actually engaging in.
Yeah.
But then something else happened, which also completely surprised me. And I just, this evening, I saw one of my friends whom I also mentioned in the book, Elke Böhme.
Mm.
And I, she offered, while I was writing, she said, you know, if you ever need a reader, I'll be there for you. I'll be happy to just simply have a look. And a few of my other friends offered, whom I trust completely. And so I always thought, yes, I'm going to give these people my manuscript in advance, mm-hmm. and they are going to read it, mm-hmm. and they are going to tell me, Karina, no, there are some passages here, you are insane, and please, you mustn't do this. And I wanted them to protect me from myself. But then I was writing, and then the first draft was finished, and the second, and the third, and then the editing was done, and at some stage I had, the seventh draft, and then it was being edited and proofread and types it. And I was promising myself, I'm going to send this out and send this out. And I never did. And the only people who saw this book before were professionals working on it. Not friends and not family and not dear ones, not even my brother with whom I share everything. Mm. And then I realized that I did not want to be protected from myself, that I needed to say this, and I didn't want anybody to stop me. So it had to come, and it had to come this way. And the only thing that I definitely wanted help with is because I came into this project not only as a woman and as a wife, but also very much as a writer. Mm. And I wanted to honor Andre in words. Mm. It was his medium of also being in the world. Words and literature were extremely precious to him. And so I wanted help on that professional level. I wanted an editor who will take me to task, and I wanted a proofreader who will say, this is still not good enough. I wanted people to tell me, you can do better. Mm-hmm. And they did, and they pushed me, and they pushed me really hard. And it was easier to be pushed by strangers.
Mm. Yeah, I relate to that. I'm joined in studio by Karina Szczurek, author of The Fifth Mrs. Brink and The Fifth Mrs. Brink. Or maybe it's the sixth. We're not quite sure.
We haven't looked in the attic.
We haven't worked it out yet. There's still the attic to go into. If you have a question for Karina, do give us a call. 021-446-0567 is the number to dial, or you can SMS 31567. Perhaps you saw Karina at the Open Book Festival this week and would like to make a comment or give your opinion. Perhaps that you just want to say, what a great book, which is what I'm essentially doing. You say that when you arrived on the doorstep of Jonathan Ball Publishers, you felt like a refugee who'd found a safe haven. The idea of home and havens is present throughout the book. Is home where the heart is? And if so, where is your heart?
Home in a transcendent way. Yes, definitely where the heart is. And also, I think home can be located in the relationships that you form with people who are most important to you. And it does not necessarily have to be family, I think. There are certain people who will come to you in your life who will create that space where you will always feel safe. And I'm extremely fortunate that I do not have any blood relatives in South Africa. And going now through the process of grieving for 2.5 years, I am certain that I would not have survived this without my friends. They held me, and they were that home that went missing in that sense. But the other home that I definitely have, which I have not had in my life until I came to live in South Africa, is that real physical building in which I live now. Mm. That for the first time, because I led a life of moving around, of migrating, of moving across
very
continents.
Very transient, yeah.
And everything was unstable, and everything was unpredictable. And when I came to live in South Africa, for the first time, I was there in a building with four walls and a roof that I knew if I wanted to, I could actually stay in forever. Mm. And that, for somebody who has never had that experience before, was an incredible feeling of safety. Mm. So I had a moment a few months ago where, for whatever reason, there was interest from people from the outside in buying the property. And I had phone calls from agents whether I would be prepared to sell this house. And I eventually said to the third caller, I said to her, you know what, I don't want to be unkind, but please take me off whatever list you have, whatever interest there is, and do not bother me, because if I can, I'm going to die in this house. Mm. So I'm not saying, and don't bother me, and please don't call.
Sure. Sure. So this is home.
South Africa, definitely. And the family that I've created here, and that physical building, and the three furry ones who live with me.
Yeah. What would Andrea thought of the book?
I hope that he would have been proud, because he was somebody who always also pushed his own boundaries. And he was somebody who cared about language and about storytelling deeply. And I think that I have never ever pushed myself as hard as with this particular text. And also with this kind of pushing of my own boundaries as a human being and as a writer.
Mm.
So it was, I think that he would have understood on a much more personal level, because Andre also, in his work, he broke a lot of rules and made people aware of so many things by being very brave. And I still have people coming up to me and saying, you know what, when we were in, I don't know, grade something this or university here, and we started reading Andre Breng, he opened our mind. He made people aware of the political situation in South Africa, but also of personal things. He wrote about sexuality in ways that nobody has done before in South Africa. So he also broke these rules, and he pushed boundaries of what is tellable in stories in the Southern African context. And I'm not doing any of that.
Mm.
But I think on an intimate and personal level, I've pushed myself as much as I could at this stage.
Yeah, yeah. Would you be kind enough to read a passage or two from the book, The Fifth Mrs. Brink?
The one that I chose is really related to the present moment because it relates to the book launch, and the book launch is responsible for the Open Book Festival that just ended, at which we met and participated on a panel. And so it relates to the book launch and to the founder of the festival and the director of the festival, Mervin, and the people who work with him. Just before the scheduled official handover of Flame in the Snow, I was at the book launch and gently inquired whether by any chance they already had any copies. They didn't. The following night, I was once again at the book launch for the launch of an unrelated title I didn't even remember any longer. Just after the event, I was paying for my purchases when one of the booksellers, Luann, spotted me and said that the first copies of Flame in the Snow had come in during the day, and she ran off to get one for me. I settled mine account with an uncontrolled hammering in my heart. The launch crowd was gradually dispersing, but there was still quite a lot of people and noise around when Luann returned and placed Flamme in the Snow in my hands. And I was unprepared, notwithstanding what I had thought beforehand. After all the camaraderie and joy of putting the book together in theory, the physicality of it was so overwhelmingly real that I did not know what to do. I simply burst into tears in the middle of the book launch and ran downstairs, where mercifully there were hardly any people left. I sat down on one of the benches, the tears streaming down my face, at a loss to understand what the shocking sadness was about. My friend Liesl brought me water, put her arm around me. We sat for a while in silence. Desperately, I was searching inside for an explanation for my reaction. The tears kept coming, and finally with them, the simple answer, again, Andre should have been there. While I felt him during the process of getting it ready for publication, abruptly it hit me that his presence, like the book in the making, had been all in my head only. And it became clear that once the book left the realm of imagination and hopes and became reality, as it did in my trembling, tired hands, the process was over. There is no doubt that that birth was accompanied by a joy just as radiant, but it was empty because it could not be shared with the only person it was meant to be shared with. It was that emptiness, the utter loneliness, that was pouring out of me as I sat there next to Liesl. I explained my feelings to her, then Mervin, the owner of the bookshop. They understood. Mervin hugged me and insisted on giving me the book as a present when I wanted to pay for it. I went back to the desolation of our home. It was one of the loneliest nights of my life.
Yeah.
Whew. Hmm. We spoke about home earlier.
Mm.
Home is also that family that we experienced at Open Book. And the book launch is in a way a literary home for me. And the people, writers that I have the privilege of engaging with. Mm. And I also know that being part of the local writing community is also one of the things that saved me in this process of trying to somehow reassemble my life after the shattering of Andre's death.
Yeah. Let's talk about your writing process. Are you very disciplined? Are you somebody that wakes up at 5 a.m. and writes for 2 hours and then gets on with the rest of your day? Are you like me that you do it in bursts?
I think I'm more like you. I had this vision right in the beginning when I moved to South Africa. I was still working on my dissertation on Nadine Gordimer, who was very religious about how she worked. So it was from 9 to lunchtime, and nobody dared to interrupt. That was her holy time of writing. And I always thought, well, I can do this. I can get up and start at 9 and work until lunchtime and be very productive and creative. But then I tried this for quite a long time, and I was failing at it so miserably, and I felt hopeless and helpless. And then I looked at when I actually do my work. When do I write all the things that I do write? And I realized that my time is usually in the afternoons, which is a weird time for most people. Mm. I don't sleep during the day. I don't like being asleep during daytime. And so after lunch, I usually have a coffee. I'm completely in love with coffee. So I will have my afternoon coffee. And if I'm working, that will be the most productive time. Mm. But there will be then other occasions where something is so urgent and so burning inside me, then everything falls away and doesn't matter. And there were times when I was writing this book where really nothing was happening apart from me writing the book and occasionally sleeping and feeding the cats.
Yeah.
Because they do not tolerate any kind of slippage in that respect.
Yeah.
So I have no rhythm. I have no word counts. I work when I can, and then I'm extremely productive. And ever since I gave up that idea that there has to be a rhythm and that there has to be a word count and that you have to, you basically, when you do that and you cannot fulfill it, you set yourself up for constant failure.
Yeah.
And I just felt like this loser the whole time. And once I gave this up and I thought, okay, when it comes, and then you just need to be very good at it.
Yeah.
And that works for me. And it doesn't matter then for 10 days out of, I don't know, 3 months or so, I will disappear from the world and do whatever needs to be done.
Yeah.
But if there is any kind of routine, then afternoons are my best time. Yeah. And I love reading in the mornings. If I can stay in the morning in bed and read, that is my best time for reading.
What does literary success look like to you?
I think I'm experiencing it truly for the first time now, and not in ways that people might think. It is that feeling of when you put out anything into the world as a writer, you obviously have ideas about it for yourself, and you have hopes for whatever you share with others. But until this book, those mostly remained unrealized. So I would have hopes and ideas for what I was doing. Mm. And there would be a few people who might understand what was happening and appreciate it and then say, well, you know, I really got this and thank you. But until this book, I never felt that those reactions corresponded to exactly with my hopes and my dreams.
Mm.
And I was extremely scared with this one. I thought, this will go either way. People will either completely hate me for what I've written, or they will understand and feel compassion for that experience. And this is what it turned out to be. And I've been getting the most beautiful messages from readers, which every single day I am just so grateful for, because of precisely why I write in the first place and why I read in the first place. I read because I don't want to feel alone in the world.
Yeah.
And knowing that somebody understands makes you feel slightly more alive.
Yeah.
and real and accepted. And I had very funny reactions to the books, as well, or unusual, where people would say, oh, you know, that weird thing that you do with objects, I kind of do that too, and this is what I do. Or somebody also came up to me and couldn't explain what the book meant. She just came up to me and wanted to hug me and was in tears. And she was shaking when her friend took a photograph of us, and she couldn't say. So I have no idea what happened to this woman, but there must have been something in that book that she felt somehow
resonated with
her, yeah. and she needed to just shake my hand, which was very, very moving. And
yeah.
And I know that as a reader, when I have those kind of experiences, what it means to me. So if I can offer that to anybody out there in the world, I am so grateful for that.
Yeah. Before we wrap up, what are your fondest memories of Andre, and what do you miss about him the most?
The everyday. Just the everyday. The waking up together, and really, no matter what we went through, and no matter how difficult sometimes our discussions were, and the pains that we were working through, there was something about that they were never carried into the next day.
Mm.
We always sat there for as long as it was needed, and we would always then wake up and smile. And I'm not sort of making this up. I'm not pretending. I'm not glamorizing this. It was that simple joy of, and there you are, and I have that privilege. So the simple things of the everyday, because we spent so much time together, and it was always such a good thing to be in each other's presence. I do miss that the most. It's not the excitement of all the also really amazing things that we managed to do together, the traveling and the literary things and the projects that we worked on. All of that is still out there in the world, but that every day is gone, and I don't know whether that can ever be regained.
Do you feel robbed of your time with him, or of time with him?
Not really. There is something about when Andre died, no matter how horrific it was for me, there is something about the way he died and when he died and the fact that he died on his own terms, and that it was the kind of death that he always said that he wanted, that it was quick and that he didn't suffer, that he wasn't bedridden for 10 years, and that he went up on this incredible high of being celebrated and loved and appreciated, because when he died, we were flying back from a ceremony where he received an honorary doctorate that really meant a lot to him, and he died flying over Africa, which I afterwards I thought, well, Andre never did anything in an ordinary way. So, of course, his death had to be spectacular. And so in that sense, you know, I don't want to think of fate or what was meant to be or wasn't meant to be. I don't feel robbed, because the time that we did have together, we made the most of it.
Mm.
And there are no regrets. There is just this joy of remembering and being proud that we had the guts to risk it, and we lived it, and we loved living it.
Yeah.
And that will stay with me forever. And all I can hope for is that after the initial phase, when he died, so many other things happened to me that were really, really awful. And I did not handle everything in a way that I can be proud of. now for the future, I hope that moving forward, I will be able to build on the time that I spent with him, and not make those other mistakes that I made before I met him and after he died. So I remain hopeful that I will be able to fulfill that promise that I made to him, that I would live and that I would experience joy again.
What is next for you, and will you remain always the fifth Mrs. Brink, or are you Karina Sturek?
I am actually Karina Brink. So that is my married name. I only write under my maiden name. And so the Karina Sturek will remain definitely in that respect. At this stage, I honestly and truly cannot imagine ever getting married again. So I don't think that there will be a third Mr. Sturek, or that I will be. But I want to continue writing, and I want to be able to really give what the people who are in my life deserve, and that is the best of me. And so that is what I hope for.
I am loving the book. You are a generous and beautiful writer, and I thank you for writing this book, and I thank you for coming in and sharing a part of yourself with us here on Cape Talk. Karina Sturek, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. I can only say the same about you and your book, so lots of gratitude from my side as well. Thank you.
Thank you.